Our next presenter, we have Larry Olson, Asbury College, divine act of nature visible only through faith.
Well, I have been gratified today to see, I think, three references now to C.S. Lewis. I'm not sure if that has great significance or not. But there's mine. So, do we? Is it beneficial to turn off the front bank of lights? Is this good?
There we go.
Okay. Here's my quote, C.S. Lewis from The Four Loves. This is my conclusion. I'm going to start with my conclusion. If you take nature as a teacher, she will teach you exactly the lessons you had already decided to learn. So nature doesn't teach as much. My title, Divine Action in Nature, Visible Only Through Faith, and there's some other things implied in there. If you are lacking in faith, then you really, you either cannot or you will not see God in nature. You could also make the statement that about how does God work? For those who are not willing, are not seeking Him, God does not compel or drag anyone into his understanding. I want to look at three different areas. Scientifically, can we get data? Can we get statistics to prove God's action? My proposal is no. Ontological, rational arguments from philosophy, proofs of God. Can you prove God rationally, philosophically? My answer is no. And then scriptural perspectives. One thing: is this really what the Bible says? Is this what it tells us about how God acts and works? In terms of scientific data, my first example deals with the effectiveness of prayer. It's well documented that a person's personal faith is very effective, very important for healing. It doesn't seem to matter what your faith is. You can be Hindu, New Age, or Christian. A strong personal faith promotes healing. So I'm not saying personal prayer doesn't work. I'm just saying it doesn't prove anything. If you really want to try to prove things, you really have to go to controlled studies. So what we're really looking at here is intercessory prayer, prayer for others. The best information I got is a meta-analysis by Jay Aston and co-workers here. He looked at different types of remote healing strategies. For intercessory prayer, he found five studies that had met his definitions, controlled studies, placebo where applicable. Of those five studies, two showed no significant effect. Two, it was marginal. One was statistically significant. So in one out of five studies, there was a statistical evidence. He also looked at other types of supernatural healing. Therapeutic touch. I guess in therapeutic touch, you don't actually touch people. You put your hands over them, and power or energy somehow flows, and healing takes place. I'm not sure I understand that. Of 11 studies, five showed a statistical significant effect. Paranormal mental healing. I guess if you can you can stand in this room and project mental powers to a person in need. Two of seven studies showed significant effect. So what do you conclude from this? Apparently therapeutic touch is the most effective method of healing. You could conclude that researchers who show positive effects are more likely to publish than researchers who don't. I mean, there could be a self-bias in the data reporting. What the authors concluded is that it merits further study. That was their conclusion. Second piece of data. Does God protect us? So this is mortality data, courtesy of the insurance companies. If you are a 40-year-old male, non-smoker, average good health, you really shouldn't be dying. These would be abnormal, untimely deaths, is what the insurance company is looking at here. So I compared four different companies. Two are Christian, two are secular, and these are the rates. The numbers here, someone in average health, someone in good health. 10 years ago when I was actually that age, I would have qualified for that rate. I'm not sure I do anymore. If you look at it, there's really not a big difference in the rates. The one that stands out the most is the Southern Baptist Convention. And there's a reason for that. They did not distinguish between average, good, and others. They are basically providing insurance for employees of the church. So I think the goal here is that the church would provide the insurance for the employees. And it really is the concept of, it's what insurance is supposed to be, pooled risk. So everybody goes into that same pool. So I think that would also include some people in less good health. So I think that's actually a compliment to the Baptists, that they get back to the concept of what insurance is really supposed to be about. So do Christians live longer, healthier? Do they have fewer early, untimely deaths? Apparently not. Not according to the insurance companies. My comment down here at the bottom, do we believe in answered prayer? Well, I believe in answered prayer. I believe God does bless us, protect us, but apparently, how do we understand it? Is it quantitative? Are we blessed quantitatively with more good health, or does God answer prayer more through timing, circumstances? Is God trying to accomplish things through our trials and hardships? To sermonize. I guess it's okay to have pastoral comments in your presentation. I think sometimes we do pray wrong. We always pray that they get better. And how often do we say, God, how are you working through this situation? I'm not saying we shouldn't pray for people to get better. But I think sometimes God answers prayers in ways that we aren't necessarily seeing. So does this prove God? No. We haven't proven God yet. If you go to the philosophical approach, Thomas Aquinas had his five proofs of God. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not sure how much I... Everything on these next few pages is my effort to paraphrase people I don't really know very well. Aquinas was very important in church history and scientific history. He really brought the Aristotelian thinking and worldview into our teaching and the church doctrine. The other thing Aquinas did is he was the first theologian to really develop a complete Christian worldview or a Christian philosophical system. So, I mean, there are other people who've had their proofs of God, but I think Aquinas is very well known for these. Number one, every motion is caused or initiated by some other motion. That sounds true. Therefore, there must be a prime mover. Aquinas' argument here is with the problem of infinities. He's not concerned with the infinity on the timeline. His problem with infinities of causational levels. That if you try to go vertical in your types of causes, that you really can't have that kind of infinity. So there must be some primary source, some prime mover. Number two, every object has a formative, efficient cause. Therefore, there must be an ultimate, efficient cause. That doesn't even make any sense unless you've studied Aristotle. If you understand Aristotle's concept of matter and form, then this is another one of those infinity type arguments. Number three, contingent, non-necessary beings and things ultimately require some self-sufficient being. This table does not have to exist. Somebody decided that it should exist. You do not have to exist. Your parents presumably decided to have a child. So we are all contingent beings, and once again, you get this problem of infinities. A contingent being is caused by a contingent being, but then at some point, doesn't there have to be a self-sufficient, non-contingent being? Number four, we can recognize goodness, beauty. We can identify variations in quality. Therefore, if there are variations in quality, there must be some ultimate perfection. And who else but God would ultimate perfection be? Number five, action in nature displays a purpose or a plan. Once again, you have to go read your Aristotle to understand some of the concepts there. Therefore, there must be a planner. We are not exactly Aristotelian in our thinking anymore. I think we've cleaned house on Aristotle. If you try to take that language and translate it into our modern scientific vocabulary. This is my effort down here. So here's like my translation of Aquinas' five proofs. Energy and matter in the universe must have a source. The laws of nature must have a source. The universe has a beginning, once again, the Big Bang concept, and therefore must be contingent on something superphysical. The physical world must be contingent on something non-physical. Innate perception of good or evil implies a source of truth. Intelligent design and fine-tuning requires a designer. So, what would the greatest minds respond to those five statements? Here's a couple of great minds. Einstein was a deist. He believed in a God, but it was not the personal God of the Bible. It was not a God that interfered with the workings of nature. Stephen Hawking, first time I read some of his stuff, I thought, this guy's an atheist. And then I read back through it again and realized, not exactly. He's really more of an agnostic. Now, there's two kinds of agnostics. Agnostics that say we can't know the answer, and agnostics that say we don't know the answer. And Hawking really fits in that second category. So I'm calling him a fair-minded agnostic. Is that okay? Can we have that? But not spiritually open. Here's what he would, I really know what Steve Hawking would say. I tried to extract these things out of his comments in A Brief History of Time, so I actually do have a source here. The energy matter of the universe must have a source. According to Hawking, the total energy content or value of the universe is zero. And what he says is energy plus matter simply cancels out the binding energy. If you think of gravity as dropping things down a hole, things don't gain energy as they drop down a hole. They're losing energy. Essentially, gravitational binding is a negative quantity. So what he's saying is that actually the gravitational negative energy in the universe is simply equal to energy plus, well, let's get energy and matter are interconvertible, equals mc squared. So they just cancel out. I think the whole story is a little bit more complicated than that. You have to get into inflationary theory, the value of omega. But Hawking would say that really the universe has no energy. You can simply say it's a quantum fluctuation. The universe just randomly decided to pop into existence. There is nothing there. Number two, the laws of nature must have an author. Really, that depends on how you view the laws of nature. Are they very complicated, very fine-tuned? Or are the laws of nature really something simpler? We're making too big a deal out of it, so I'm going to come back to that. Number three, physical universe has a beginning. It's contingent on something superphysical. And once this gets back to, do we really understand the laws of nature? If we get down to the Planck scale, the moment of the Big Bang, where all the laws of nature have folded together into one law, and space is how many dimensional? 7, 12? Do we really understand how the laws of nature work? Do we really understand the nature of time? One of our mathematicians was mentioning that time can be viewed as a complex number that goes in cycles. If you read Hawking's work, he talks about a cyclical universe and some of these options. So do we really know that there was a beginning? Well, maybe not. Number four, innate perception of good and evil. I think if you talk to most scientists nowadays, you know, there are evolutionary, sociological, you know, psychological reasons why we identify good or bad. I mean, ethics is a science nowadays. So that's a non-starter. That's actually not a question. Don't worry about number four. Number five, a little bit more to say on number five. Intelligent design and fine-tuning requires a designer. Let's go back and talk about the laws governing the universe. If you're studying Newtonian mechanics, it takes about a semester to teach students Newtonian mechanics. And it appears to be this very complicated subject. What Hawking says is that not really. If you look at Newtonian mechanics, you start with just a few propositions. Space is three-dimensional. Time's not really an independent variable in Newtonian mechanics. Three-dimensional space. Energy is conserved, force equals mass times acceleration. There's lots of other laws and equations in Newtonian mechanics, but in fact they can be derived. Mechanics is a system where everything works together. There's multiple ways to solve a problem. If you just start with like three statements, all the rest follow. So the laws of nature are not that complicated. If you go to special relativity, same story. Space is now four-dimensional, or somebody was saying 3.5. Mass plus energy is conserved. Force times time is not acceleration; it's change in momentum. And you need a separate. You need to talk about relativistic momentum rather than Newtonian momentum. But you take that once. Now you can derive the rest of special relativity, general relativity. Once again, you just start with a few. So the laws of nature, are they really that complicated? When the Big Bang happened and there were these laws of nature, are there really that many ways the laws of nature could have been, or is it really pretty set and predetermined? There weren't that many options on the laws of nature. Fine-tuning of fundamental constants, gravity, Planck's constant, all those other good things, permittivity of space, permeability of space. I think Hawking says there are 13 fundamental constants. To us, they look separate and fundamental. His argument is, once again, we don't really know how these laws of nature really work. Maybe when all these dimensions fold back together, you'll find out there's not that many independent fundamental constants. Maybe there's only two or three fundamental constants. So how many ways, the fine-tuning of the universe, well, how many different ways could the universe have really been? Maybe it's not that big a number. So, when the universe was happening, we get into this, okay, the universe is a certain, there is this fine-tuning. We are here, the universe is a certain way. So you get into this anthropic principle. There's the weak anthropocentric or anthropic principle and the strong. I get real fuzzy with these definitions of the weak and the strong principle. I don't know, maybe I'm not the only one. So I'm kind of going to what Steve Hawking said. Weak anthropic principle, if the universe has a large potentiality space, I mean, there's been 4 billion years, the universe has looked different during those 14 billion years of time. There are many different places in the universe that look different. There's this vast potentiality of things that could happen. So if, in fact, there aren't that many options to the laws of nature, then if the universe has lots of potentiality space, then surely at some point in time we would be here. We would look out and see everything a certain way. So not so amazing. It's amazing, but not so amazing. The coincidence is not really that big under the weak set of conditions. Strong principle is if the universe really does not have that much potentiality space, or if the laws of nature are more complicated, then you get into saying things like there's infinite parallel universes, or the universe is cycling but never the same, and you get into these statements which are more and more hard to believe. And this is where Hawking, he quivers here. He actually says, you know, like there might be arguments for God. But then he says that actually I don't like that because it would take all the fun out of science. Like the point of science is to explain everything, so what fun would that be? He doesn't say he disagrees with the final statement. He just says he doesn't like it. So he is not convinced. Scriptural. What does Scripture have to say? And what a few passages does not make a thorough exegesis of this subject. I picked out two passages, Matthew and Acts, how Jesus responded to a couple of individuals that came to him. Matthew 16, Sadducees and Pharisees came to Jesus to test him, and they asked him for a sign to heaven, a sign from heaven, and he replied no. It was, of course, a ridiculous question. Jesus is a couple years into his ministry. He's done all kinds of miraculous signs. The Pharisees and Sadducees, they're asking for a sign, but that's really not what their point. They're not seeking God. They're not seeking God. Jesus' answer was no. Second passage is Jesus' revelation to Paul on the road to Damascus. Of course, the light shines from heaven. Paul falls down, and he asks, "Who are you, Lord?" And this is an interesting statement. He has no idea what happened, but he responds with, "Who are you, Lord?" So here's somebody who didn't know he was seeking Jesus. He didn't understand who Jesus was, but in fact his heart was right. He was seeking. So in this case, Jesus answered the question that Paul hadn't actually asked yet. So a contrast between these two situations. Where and why does God choose to reveal himself? Isaiah and Matthew, parallel scriptures from Old and New Testament. In Isaiah, he is told to prophesy, but nobody's going to listen except a small remnant. In the New Testament, we have the parable of the sower. He goes out, he sows his seeds in all these bad places. Nothing grows, nothing happens. But there's also the good soil. What does Jesus or God the Father, how does he respond to all these other individuals, the rocky places, the hard places? How does God respond? He doesn't do anything. Those who don't want to listen go their own way, presumably to perdition. So once again, we see where and how does God actually choose to act? Final passage, and this is one where a lot of attention, this is probably familiar to everybody, Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but in their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. In verse 20, we say, God has revealed himself. Everybody has seen him. And in the next verse, it says men's hearts were foolish and darkened. So we get this thing, they should see him, but they don't see him, or they could have seen him, but they chose not to see him. How do you really interpret this verse? If you look at the context, what Paul is really getting at is that men are without excuse. I mean, that's the point he's trying to make. But I think it does raise very good questions. Could everybody have seen God at some point, or they did see God at some point but turned away? And I think there is a little bit of a mystery there. I think there is a point. We were talking about all the good Calvinist presenters today down here. I tried to leave myself open. One either needs a predisposition or prevenient grace in order to be able to see God's work in creation. Without that, you really just can't. It's not there. God does not force anybody or coerce anybody against their will to see him at work. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you.
Somebody back could get the light there. Yeah. That's amazing. I've never given a talk in 20 minutes. Yes?
Can I go back to your non-starter?
Okay. The non-starter was the sense of good and evil, morality, innate morality.
In
C.S. Lewis liked that argument.
Yeah.
I was, of course, speaking on behalf of Steve Hawking.
Yeah. Isn't it true, though, that people who tend to ridicule that argument, aren't they shocked by their own conclusions? Don't they say that it's not true that there is a real good and evil, often to shock you, or are they themselves are shocked by their own conclusions?
I don't know.
Believe in good and evil themselves, they, by reason, presumably come to a different conclusion, but inevitably are doing that to shock you or they themselves.
Let me go to the quote from Romans. At some point in time, people had a conscience, or they should have had a conscience, and I think some people respond to that. I mean, it is a way that God can reach people, but obviously not everybody responds. If people harden their heart, what does God do about it? Yes?
I was interested in the data you presented on the efficacy of prayer and healing. My impression is that medical schools are increasingly including into their curricula courses on spirituality and and healing. And if the data are so unconvincing as you suggest, why are they doing that?
The question was, medical schools are increasingly including material on spirituality, so why is that? I think the prior statement that personal faith seems to be very important in healing, and I think this is where medical schools are realizing that doctors really need to be sensitive to personal faith. They need to, you know, if you want to go sit at somebody's bedside and pray with them, I don't care if you're a Hindu or what, it's probably going to help them heal faster. And I think this is what the medical schools are looking at. They're not looking at this data.
There's a Christian at Duke by the name of Dave Larson who has NIH funding that shows very contrary data to those.
Do I have a date on this? By the way, I did not make lots of copies, but any who wants a copy of this can just leave me their email address.
Yeah, it's far larger numbers, so statistical significance is far larger.
This was a 2000 study, and once again, it was a meta-analysis. The authors had gone through all the literature they could find, so there's actually 23 different studies represented here. And that's, oh, I say 2000 is the date on that. Okay.
It sounds like you're saying that from an apologetic standpoint, you're recommending we shouldn't come at people with any of these arguments saying we're going to prove to you that God exists. Do you think any of these have value apologetically as plausibility arguments that at least get you to the point of considering them?
The question is, are these arguments of any use in evangelism? I'd say yes. I think if somebody is seeking, I think if their minds are open, I think that, I'm not saying these are illegitimate arguments. I'm not opposed to prayer. But I think if somebody doesn't respond to a certain argument, change the subject. Try and find out where are they open. You know, how can I reach this person? Because I think if you go to Steve Hawking and try to, Debbie Harson, I had the picture of the beautiful symmetric galaxy up. And I don't know if I can quote exactly, but she said, "Don't you just see the handiwork of God?" And I don't think everybody would. Somebody would say, "Well, you photographed 10,000 galaxies and put the best picture on the screen." Whatever, it's a galaxy. I think if you go trying to persuade people where they're just not open to that, you don't get anywhere.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to have to
okay.
Save your questions for the discussion session coming up.